Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be looking at the way music inspires literature and literature inspires music, talking with music writer John Wirt, whose new book is Huey Piano Smith and the Rock and Ammonia Blues, and the wonderful musician Layla McCalla, whose new CD, Vari Colored Songs, a tribute to Langston Hughes, is inspired by the work of her favorite poet. John Wirt has covered music, film, and entertainment for various newspapers, including The Advocate's Baton Rouge and New Orleans editions. His first book is an invaluable contribution to New Orleans music history. It's called Huey Piano Smith and the Rock and Ammonia Blues, and it chronicles the life and times of one of the most important figures in early rock and roll. John, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
Now, we're in this kind of golden age of music writing and biography right now, with recent books about Fats Domino and Ernie Cato, and you could have had your pick of subjects, so why Huey Piano Smith?
It was the right time and the right place, because I was working in Baton Rouge at The Advocate, and Huey left New Orleans in 1980. He moved to Baton Rouge, and he dropped out of music completely, so he was quite obscure, and I didn't know where he was for years. I'd heard he was in Baton Rouge, though. And so when Huey received the 2000 Rhythm and Blues Foundation Pioneer Award, I got in touch with that group, and they put me in touch with Huey. And that after that, that was the first time I met him.
And you worked on this book for a very long time with him.
I say I worked on it for 12 years. Of course, you know, I've got a full-time job, and that takes a lot of time, so I had to do this in my spare time. And I wish I'd done it a lot quicker than I did, but it's better because there was more time spent on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about Huey's contributions. Tell us about those songs that really made the mark for him.
Well, Huey's first major hit, 1957, Rockin' Pneumonia and the Boogie Woogie Flu. It was a major R&B hit. It went into the pop charts as well, but it was bigger R&B. So, and after that, he had a follow-up hit, Don't You Just Know It. Now, Don't You Just Know It was a major pop hit. It was number 9 in 1958 on the Billboard pop charts. And it was an R&B hit, too. That really brought Huey forward, and he made an appearance on the Dick Clark Saturday Show. And Don't You Just Know It had a flip side called High Blood Pressure. Mm-hmm. High Blood Pressure is so good that it should have been an A-side. That's an example of the kind of, I think, mismanagement of Huey's career. He had great songs that should have been promoted as A-sides that weren't.
Interesting. Now, as much as this is a portrait of Huey, it's also a portrait of the city and the whole context for his musical career. So tell us a little bit about how you went about providing that big surround for his life.
Well, I spoke to a lot of Huey's peers, Earl Palmer, Earl King, Eddie Bow, a lot of the people who were still alive when I was writing this book, and a lot of them are gone at this point.
Yeah.
So I wanted to speak to his peers, and I wanted to do research on the scene. So the Louisiana Weekly, New Orleans weekly African-American newspaper, I did a lot of research in there. And the Times-Picayune didn't cover black music in that era.
Wow.
So I went to the Louisiana Weekly and found some wonderful, fascinating things about the time, including Professor Longhair, how he was actually arrested on Mardi Gras Day, and he was in jail on Mardi Gras. Things like that. So that was one way to get the scene. And of course, I've been to the city so many times, mm-hmm. and I've been around, and I went to some of the places where some of these things happened, like the Dewdrop Cafe. Now, everybody calls it a Dewdrop Inn, but all the references I saw to it in the 1950s in the Louisiana Weekly said Dewdrop Cafe.
Wow, because that was my first impulse too.
Yeah, so I made discoveries like that. And so the Dewdrop Cafe still exists. It's there on LaSalle Street. So I went by and just kind of sat there and looked at it and thought about it. And I did those kind of things as well.
Yeah. New Orleans is wonderful at providing those meditative kinds of spaces for writers of nonfiction, you know? Now, one of the most entertaining characters to stride across these pages is Bobby Marchand. They certainly seem to have had strong feelings, good times, all kinds of upheaval. I mean,
Bobby is one of the great New Orleans characters, and he got here in the early 50s with the Powder Box Review, a troupe of female impersonators. And he worked as a female impersonator, but he was also a singer, and he made some early records. One of the great early records that Huey wrote and was released by Ace Records was Bobby Marchand's Chickiwawa, a great Huey record. It's really a Huey Smith and the Clowns record, even though Huey Smith and the Clowns didn't exist at that time. That was before Rockin' Pneumonia. So Bobby is actually not on Rockin' Pneumonia. A lot of people think he is, but he's not. Rockin' Pneumonia came out before Huey formed the Clowns. So Huey knew what a great performer Bobby was. He knew what a great front man Bobby was. And Bobby loved the spotlight. He relished the spotlight, and he was so competitive. He wanted to beat everybody else on the show, and they frequently did. So Huey recruited Bobby to be his front man, and he knew he was going to be good.
Mm-hmm. What's your relationship like to these songs? Do you remember the first time you heard them and what they meant to you as a listener?
Well, honestly, the first time I heard Rockin' Pneumonia was the Johnny Rivers version in 1972. Yeah. Johnny Rivers from Baton Rouge, but he went to Los Angeles and he became a major, major star, had lots of hit records. But he grew up in Baton Rouge and he knew all these songs from New Orleans and loved them. And back in the 50s, he was playing Rockin' Pneumonia in his little high school band. So in 1972, he recorded Rockin' Pneumonia, and it became a major pop hit, much bigger than it had been by Huey in 1957. So actually, that's the first time I heard Rockin' Pneumonia, as far as I recall.
Oh, wow. So what was it like to work with Huey and talk to him for this book? I mean, biographers have to really find real connection with their subjects. You live with them for years. You get to know them pretty well if they're living. So what was that connection like for you? What did you learn from him?
The more I think about it, and I've thought about it a lot after I've written the book, is that we seem to be well matched because we're both low profile people. The group is called Huey Smith and the Clowns. That's Huey and his singers. That's not his band. The band was something else. But Huey on stage sat in the back playing the piano, even in the dark, with his singers out front. They're all out front. Unfortunately, there are very few pictures of Huey Smith and the Clowns, but there's a photograph in the book by Michael P. Smith, and Bobby is way out front in a white suit, and the light is on him. Everybody else is behind Bobby, and no one is more behind Bobby, practically, than Huey, who's way out there, way back there on the piano. So Huey is, he says he's a shy person, and he is. He's a shy person. There's this irony that he's got this group, but he's really not the main attraction on stage. He's the guy behind it all. He's the guy who creates this whole picture called Huey Smith and the Clowns, writes the songs, produces the songs, plays the piano, produces the sessions, makes the arrangements, all of that. It's whole vision. And in the way that Huey is behind it all, I'm behind it when I'm writing because I don't want to put myself forward in anything I write. It's all about my subject. So in that way, we have that similarity. Also, we're both shy people. Mm-hmm. Even though we're in a public life, I'm in journalism, he's in music.
One of the things that fascinates me about this book, and I think will fascinate a lot of readers, is that it's a story of legal turmoil. So tell us a little bit about Huey's difficulties with being treated properly by the people who recorded his music.
It's almost universal that people say Johnny Vincent, the owner and founder of Ace Records in Jackson, Mississippi, say that Johnny didn't treat them fairly. Earl King from New Orleans said that. Jimmy Clanton said that. Jimmy Clanton from Baton Rouge, who had big hits on Ace Records.
Just a Dream.
And Venus in Blue Jeans. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of people said Johnny didn't treat them right. And everything I've seen suggests that that's true. Johnny apparently would create contracts. He would have a signature and he would superimpose a signature on a contract. The contract that's been at the basis of so much of the legal haggling over Huey's songs is, I don't doubt, a forgery. So for Huey, in a lot of ways, it begins with Johnny Vincent and that Johnny Vincent was an independent guy in the Deep South. He didn't pay royalties when I say he didn't pay royalties, he didn't send statements. Nobody knew how much they were supposed to be making. Nobody had any idea because Johnny didn't do that sort of work for his artist. On the other hand, he was a good promoter. Art Rupe, one of the great people in music with Specialty Records, said Johnny had a great imagination. Mm-hmm. And after Johnny, it goes on and on and on to other people. Johnny stays in Huey's life until Johnny's death, though, in 1999. And Huey always considered Johnny a friend.
Yeah.
So there's this strange kind of relationship that they had. I think they really did appreciate each other.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that comes through loud and clear about Huey in this book is that a lot of his life was centered on family and faith as well.
Yeah, Huey loves children. He loves his family. In about 1970, he became a Jehovah's Witness. And shortly after that, he dropped completely out of music. He did return to music in the late 70s, and probably from 78 to 81, he was active in music to some degree. He played the Jazz Fest in 1981.
I know, I love that part. I love that comeback story.
Yeah, but after that, he dropped out again, and you didn't see him. So he occupied himself with studying the Bible, reading the Bible really deeply. The Jehovah's Witnesses, they do a lot of Bible study. And also, I think he found a lot of help in the Bible because, maybe he hit bottom. And so then he had to reach to a higher power, and that was in his Jehovah's Witness faith and his study of the Bible.
Now, you write a bit about how many musicians have covered this music, discovered it, been influenced by it, Aerosmith, the Beach Boys, the Grateful Dead. Do you think young people now are still discovering his music?
Well, that's a good question. Recently, I got an email from Casey McAllister. He's a keyboard player in Hooray for the Riff Raff. Uh-huh. Hooray for the Riff Raff is one of the newer groups from New Orleans who have come and made a huge splash. I don't mean top 10 hits, but they've made a national, international impression, and they're so great.
Mm-hmm.
So Carrie says, he writes me an email. He says, "Oh, I'm so excited that you've written a book about Huey. And we play Huey's music in our van." And with his band, King James and Special Men, they play Huey's songs. So there's one example. I hope more people catch on to him because it's infectious stuff and it does last over the decades. And another thing I just found out about was Huey's music was used in a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles commercial. Just last year.
Really? Oh my gosh.
A game that they had. So, and they used his song. Now, somebody else recorded it. Some young people recorded it. But there it is. Don't You Just Know It with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, my God. That is such a great song. And I can sort of see it with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
It works.
Mm-hmm. So doesn't it make you feel good to have gotten all this down in one place and pay this tribute to him?
Well, if I can stand alongside Ben Samuel's Ernie Cato book, and Rick Coleman's Fats Domino book. If I can be in their league, I'm happy with that because those are two great books about two essential New Orleans musicians. And Huey is an essential New Orleans musician too. He's not as well known as either of those guys, but he's part of the scene.
Well, this is a wonderful book. We've been talking with John Wirt, whose new book is Huey Piano Smith and the Rock and Ammonia Blues. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Susan. I want to scream.
Layla McCullough has the clear and memorable voice of a worldly wise angel. The cellist and singer has toured with the Carolina Chocolate Drops and recently released her first CD, Varicolored Songs, a tribute to Langston Hughes, after a wildly successful Kickstarter campaign. Layla moved to New Orleans in 2010, played Bach on Royal Street, and found inspiration here. I'm looking forward to talking with her about adapting her favorite poems for song in this gorgeous CD. Layla, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this CD had its inspiration in a book that your father gave you.
Mm-hmm.
And a long time ago, huh?
Yeah. The way I've described my relationship with Langston Hughes is he was someone whose name I knew. And when I was 16, my dad bought me a book of his poetry for my birthday. And it was just something that I came back to a lot throughout my late teenage years and early 20s. And then I found the anthology of Langston Hughes's poem at, I think, like a used bookstore somewhere. It was like $7 for the huge book, so how can you say no to that? And I just kept on reading the poems, and it was a time in my life in New York that I felt like kind of anxious about, you know, being creative. And I knew I wanted to be creative, but I didn't know what that meant or what that looked like. And so I started to write music to Langston Hughes's poetry. And it was great brain exercise in some way. I feel like his words are so musical and so rhythmic and so adaptable and yet not very complicated structurally.
Right.
But very complicated emotionally and mentally and historically and culturally. And so I just really enjoyed playing with those intersections, you know, in his work, and then kind of figuring out how that matches musically. And, you know, it's just really fun. Mm-hmm.
So tell me what it's like when you do that. Do you read the poem aloud over and over? And I mean, how does...
No, most of the songs I wrote with an instrument in hand, mm-hmm. and was just trying things out, you know, kind of as I go along, like very stream of consciousness kind of approach. And I just tried things that worked and tried to figure out what fit. And there was no roadmap. There wasn't a mm-hmm. kind of logic behind anything. It was just like, oh, I kind of feel like this could be in three, or I kind of feel like this could be in four, and then it changes here. And it was really a great process for me to find those moments, you know, and mm-hmm. try to really keep the words at the forefront of each piece.
Yes.
Because that was the most powerful thing. So it was like, how do I frame this so that, mm-hmm. you know, the meaning of the songs is retained and the meaning of the poems. I always get confused saying songs and poems.
Well, poems were songs from yeah. the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, but you would think all poetry would work for music, you know, but then there are these clever little things like, you know, you can sing all the Emily Dickinson poems to the tune of Yellow Rose of Texas, but that just doesn't sound right when you're actually doing
right.
it. It's just a little too zippy,
right.
but it kind of works. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like Langston Hughes's work, there's a lot of space, even in the sentences. I don't know. I don't feel like there's anything too convoluted.
Yeah.
That, you know, a lot of poems that I love are, you know, very complicated words and word choices and awkward. And, you know, it's a different expression of a different thing. But I think Langston Hughes really was interested in expressing Black culture in the United States. And there's so much music in that, you know, you can't take music away from that.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of what made it so conducive to songwriting.
Mm-hmm. And children love his work,
yeah.
too. It's very much a young person's
yeah.
poetry, a lot of it is. But then as you grow older, it resonates for you in new and different ways. So
yeah.
it has that great lifespan in a reading life or a poetry lover's life, too. Love Again Blues is one of those songs that's about a situation everybody's going to run up against sooner or later, right?
Right.
So how much fun was it to write that one?
It was a lot of fun. Langston Hughes wrote a lot of blues poems, and that was just one that stood out to me as very universal. The idea that you always go back to love, even if it breaks your heart a million times, you know? It's like a part of human survival, human instinct. It felt very natural.
Mm-hmm. I love that song so much. So why don't we hear a little bit of Love Again Blues now?
My life ain't nothing but a lot of God knows what. My life ain't nothing but a lot of God knows what. Just one thing after another added to the troubles I've got. When I had you, I thought I had me an angel child. When I had you, I thought I had an angel child. You turned out to be the devil. You mighty night drove me wild. Tell me what makes love such an age. Tell me what makes love such an ache and a pain. Well, a it takes you and it breaks you, but you got to love again.
That was Love Again Blues from Varicolored Songs, a tribute to Langston Hughes. It's a new CD from Layla McCullough. Another thing that I read was that you did some research on Langston Hughes' life. And one of the things that impressed you as you were doing that research was finding out how difficult his life as a public poet was, that when he toured, that things were not easy at all.
Yes. When you think of these sort of legends of the past in American history, you assume that they just were legends and things just happened easily. But I think that part of what was so inspiring about Langston Hughes is not just the work that he created, but the integrity and how it shaped his life, you know? I think that when you have a creative life, it's something that you really have to fight for a while, even when you're at the top of your game, you know? Even when everything is going well to the outside world. I think that the challenges that he faced as a black man in the United States could have really discouraged his creativity. And he seems to have not let it get in the way of him creating work. Mm-hmm. And that was really inspiring to me.
And you realize how even a great poet, a beautiful, eloquent poet, mm-hmm. who goes out on a tour in the time of segregation, so undefended as a public person, so completely vulnerable,
yeah.
and just putting it all on the line every time.
Yeah.
And when you came to New Orleans, one of the things that you did was play music on the street. That seems to me a kind of equivalent of making yourself vulnerable and putting it all out there on the line. What is that like for you?
Well, you know, it's funny because I didn't really feel that way at the time. Now, looking back, I realize, and talking about it more, you know, throughout the release of this album, it's like, yeah, that was a gutsy move.
Oh, yeah.
But at the time, it felt like that's just what I'm going to do with my life. And I knew that that would just allow me to survive in New Orleans and support myself and not feel like I'm drowning. And I also really felt this need to connect with my instrument. And it was really fun for me to put myself out there in that way. It felt like it was something that I knew, you know, at a time when I didn't know, or it felt like I didn't know a lot of things about what I wanted for my life, you know. I knew that I wanted to play and be seen somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was, you know, the main sort of impetus. And I definitely had moments on the street where I thought, okay, how long can I really do this?
Yeah.
Am I going to be here for the next 5 years really doing this? Because I have friends that play on the street all the time and they still do that. And that's still mm-hmm. a major part of their income. And I knew that that wasn't quite right for me because I knew that I played guitar and I was started playing tenor banjo around that time.
Right.
And I started learning about Haitian music. And, you know, I knew that I wanted to do more than just play classical music. And it was the beginning of me giving myself the space to really create this album, explore Haitian music, enable it to push me further into my heritage and my history and my roots, and if that was going to be a part of my work. And that time was so sacred in my life, you know? It was different, and people enjoyed it, and people liked it, and it provided a lot of people, I think, you know, tourists and locals, an opportunity to just sit.
Now, you know, poetry itself is such an act of devotion, and adapting someone else's words to music, that's another terrific act of devotion. Can you think of any other poets that would inspire this in you?
I think Robert Frost and Walt Whitman. Oh, just so many people. It's funny, it's moved a little bit lately for me out of poetry and more into stories and just things that I've been reading in general. I read Isabel Allende's An Island Beneath the Sea.
Uh-huh.
And I recently read a book called A Day for the Hunter, A Day for the Prey by a writer named Gage Avril that's about power and music and politics in Haiti. And it just.
And we should say that you are Haitian. Yeah. You have a Haitian background.
Yeah.
<so.
laughs> Yeah. And I'm even reading The Tao of the Wu-Tang Clan by the RZA right now. And it's a very spiritual autobiography. Yeah, for me, it's more reading people's lives and reading history books. There's another incredible book called Louisiana Sojourn.
Oh, isn't that a great
book? Do you know that book?
Yes.
Yeah.
By Frank DeCaro.
Yeah.
That's those collections of traveler's tales.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful
book. Reading, you know, Zora Neale Hurston's experience of voodoo in New Orleans in the 1920s. And
belief in magic is older than writing. That's one of my favorite quotes.
Storms that happen in New Orleans, cockfighting in Louisiana. There's just so, I feel like this area in particular is so rich with story.
Right, we're very lucky.
And I think that so many songs can come from that.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, we'll be waiting. We've been talking with Layla McCalla, whose wonderful new CD is Varicolored Songs, a tribute to Langston Hughes. Thank you so much, Layla.
Thank you.
Way down south in Dixie, break the heart of me. They hung my black young lover to a crossroad tree. Way down south in Dixie, bruised body high in the air. I asked the white Lord Jesus, what was the use of prayer? Way down south in Dixie, break the heart of me. Love is a naked shadow on an arm. The naked tree.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Midnight in Peking by Paula French, Tuesday, August 5th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Sensation by Nick Mamadas, Saturday, August 9th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. There will be a publication party for Maple Leaf Rag 5, Sunday, August 10th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. 80 writers are represented in this fifth anthology, and the Maple Leaf Reading Series is also celebrating its 35th year of continuous weekly poetry readings. And Benoit discusses New Orleans' best ethnic restaurants, Tuesday, August 12th at 6:30 at Author Night at the Humble Branch Library. The Authors and Readers Convention takes place August 14th through 17th at the Marriott on Canal Street. Featured authors include Heather Graham and A.L. Jackson, along with dozens more. Events include a haunted history ghost tour, a Florida Diva party at Trashy Diva, and a masquerade costume ball. Check out authorreadercon.com for more information or to register. And Heather Graham's Writers for New Orleans takes place August 29th through 31st at the Hotel Monteleone. If you're an aspiring writer, especially of genre fiction, this is a good conference for you, with panel discussions and opportunities to meet editors and agents. Among the authors slated to attend, in addition to Heather Graham, are Julie Smith, Jacqueline Michard, and Chris Mooney. Check out writersforneworleans.com for more information or to register. And don't forget, the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library book sale continues every Wednesday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Ladder Library Carriage House. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.